So thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. And sorry for running in at the last minute here. I think dark is probably better. Well, the screen should be dark. Yeah.
Is that okay?
I would.
Yes.
Yeah, let me try. Okay.
So the title of my talk is Scrambling or Preserving Quantum Information with Cold Atoms and Light. And I thought I would just take a moment to just give a little bit of context on where I'm coming from. So broadly, I and my research group are interested in, I would say, broadly quantum engineering with cold atoms with a variety of applications, ranging from advancing control over many particle entanglement to enhance precision measurements is sort of the background I've come from, and getting more and more interested, though, in directions towards many-body physics and quantum information. And in particular, as you know, there are many, many types of experiments with cold atoms going on in these directions. But the direction we're particularly pursuing is engineering new kinds of interactions that can open up new directions of investigation. And I'm particularly interested in interactions that one can control with light. And so there will be two types of those interactions that feature in my talk. On the one hand, actually interactions between some spins, so these are internal states of atoms, interactions that are mediated by photons in an optical resonator, or interactions that are induced among neutral atoms that would ordinarily, at sort of typical spacings in an optical lattice, be non-interacting, interactions that are induced by coupling those atoms to highly excited Rydberg states that do have long-range van der Waals. And so in both of these cases, these are interactions that are sort of not there until I turn on a laser. And so that raises the possibility of having very fast dynamical control of interactions, the unique possibility of controlling, sort of dynamically controlling the sign of interactions. And that opens then new directions in studies of non-equilibrium dynamics or engineering new types of Fouquet Hamiltonians. So a second kind of unique feature that will come up is the ability to have interactions that are effectively non-local, and that will also open potentially new directions in quantum simulations. Okay, so I wanted to talk today about two particular applications I've recently become intrigued by, and the one is for studying scrambling of quantum information in many-body systems, kind of inspired by a lot of recent theoretical work that's come from the community of thinking about black holes. And then the sort of second direction I'll go into, sort of to flip it around, is preserving quantum information, so exploring directions in engineering topological states of matter. Okay. So I think this, how many in this audience are theorists? Yeah, so I'm actually a little bit nervous talking to you because many of you probably understand these things more deeply than I do, but I want to sort of give you my experimentalist perspective on some directions we can go here. So there's been a lot of excitement recently about the question of quantum information scrambling. So the question is essentially, I have some many-body system and I have some qubit that's locally encoded. How long does it take for the interactions in this system to completely delocalize that information, so for this qubit to become fully entangled with all degrees of freedom in the system? Okay, so this process is called scrambling, and the sort of thinking about it was inspired by the effort to understand sort of the information problem in black holes. And the fact that one can, of course, even say anything about quantum information in black holes in a rigorous way derives from this ADS-CFT duality that relates quantum field theories in D spatial dimensions to classical theories in one additional spatial dimension. And the sort of particularly intriguing idea here is that there are certain strongly correlated quantum field theories that, when one renormalizes the degrees of freedom, give rise to an emergent geometry that is that of a black hole in anti-de Sitter space. And so one question that you can ask here is, you know, could one realize quantum many-body systems in tabletop experiments that are holographically dual to black holes? And what I'll sort of address even more is if, you know, if you could, how might you know? And so the thought is, well, one thing you could look at is, in fact, the way that quantum information is scrambled in the many-body system. Okay. And the reason that that might tell you something is that there's a very well-grounded conjecture that black holes, or the many-body systems, the field theory is holographically dual to them, saturate a fundamental bound on the rate of information scrambling. And the bound is as follows. So essentially, if I perturb a black hole, there's some time scale for relaxation of local observables that's just set by the temperature, which is kind of our one energy scale. But there's a longer time scale that increases with the entropy for that perturbation to spread over the entire system. Okay. And this kind of makes sense, right, that it should be faster for local observables to equilibrate than for this information to spread, and the spreading time should scale with the number of degrees of freedom. Okay, and sort of to get an intuition, though, for why it should scale in this way, there's an intuition that can be gained by constructing kind of a simple toy model of this system of entropy S as a system of S qubits. And so the idea is if the time scale for pairs of qubits to interact is what I call tau, then, and if I'm sort of only allowing two-body interactions, then the fastest that I can expect information to delocalize over this entire system, if I want that to happen very quickly, what I should maybe do is first sort of allow random pairs of these qubits to interact, and then in each time step of length tau, switch who's interacting in this way. And if I do this, then the time for all pairs to have talked to each other is going to just go as is going to be essentially log 2 of the number of qubits. Okay, so that's kind of an intuition for why this should be a bound on the scrambling time. Okay, so there are a couple of ingredients then that you might look for a system to scramble quickly. One thing that's sort of unusual about this type of picture is that we have non-local interactions. So that's kind of one ingredient that one should look for. And then another sort of notion is that this scrambling, this sort of fast spreading of a perturbation should be linked in some way to chaos. Okay. So first I want to actually ask the question, how might one engineer non-local interactions actually in the lab? And I alluded to this briefly at the beginning. The essential idea is that there's actually a physical system that we're setting up in my lab where the goal is to have atoms that interact by essentially scattering photons amongst each other in an optical resonator. And so what you can imagine is some atoms confined in a lattice. They're spatially pinned, but they have two internal states that form a spin degree of freedom. And if I now send in some light here from the side, I can engineer a process whereby, for instance, if I start with two spin-up atoms, I can engineer a process whereby an atom can absorb a photon from one of these laser beams, re-emit or scatter a photon into the resonator, and in the process flip its spin. And now, if this is a virtual process, so the photon doesn't stay here and leak out, but that photon is reabsorbed by some other atom, which, again, re-scatters that photon into the control beam and flips its spin, then this is a way of engineering some correlated spin flip processes. Okay, and so start with, for instance, two spins down and have this correlated process whereby they both flip up or other combinations. The net effect of this is to give me some interaction Hamiltonian that involves terms that go as SX, SX. Between the spins, SSI, SXJ, and you can imagine if I have local control, so if I didn't have spatial control, in principle this lets me have kind of interactions between arbitrary pairs of atoms, irrespective of their spatial separation. Okay. Another kind of unique feature of this interaction is that I can easily control the sign. So right, there's this four-photon process, so there's a detuning from an intermediate state here. This sign I can control to just flip the sign of the interaction. And the other point I want to emphasize is that in order for these interactions to be coherent, one needs to be in a regime of very strong atom-light coupling so that I can really have this be just a virtual process where the photon is not lost sort of halfway through my effort to flip these two spins. Okay, and so that will require that the atom-light coupling is strong compared to the two possible decay channels of light leaking out the mirror or being spontaneously emitted by an atom. Okay, so I want to show you that this isn't just kind of made up, this actually works. Okay, so the scheme I showed you actually has not been demonstrated, but there's something that's essentially analogous that actually is demonstrated, and where I can just show you a little data. So essentially, I showed you some scheme where we're driving the atoms. One can get essentially an equivalent interaction up to a coordinate rotation by driving the cavity load. And so there are some kind of practical differences. This kind of scheme is more versatile because I can have some spatial control to dictate which atom interacts with which other one, a little bit more technically demanding. This one is simple, but it only gives rise to actually a global interaction, a global all-to-all interaction, where all atoms are equally coupled to this mode and talk equally to each other. And so I've written this then here. In this case, what one has then is essentially simply a collective spin, so this large angular momentum S, that's the sum of all the individual ones, and some collective interaction that looks like SC squared is then the Hamiltonian. Okay, and actually the reason that this is demonstrated and has attracted interest is that it's kind of a useful Hamiltonian in the following sense. Sort of the lowest order effect of this Hamiltonian is that if I have start with an untangled state, just a coherent state of the spins pointing, say, along X here, and I apply this interaction, then essentially what this does is to generate a rotation about the z-axis that's proportional to Sz. And so the lowest order effect of that as this kind of twists this quantum state into something that is squeezed, and that's actually a state that's useful for quantum enhanced measurements. And so this was kind of proposed in the early 90s that this could be a useful thing to do. At the time, the authors in this seminal paper sort of said this would be a great Hamiltonian to have. We have no idea how to make it. But fast forward to today, and there are actually a lot of systems that realize this type of interaction, ranging from Bose-Einstein condensates, where it's actually a direct collisional contact interaction, to ion traps, where instead of it being a photon-mediated interaction, it's a phonon-mediated interaction, mediated by some collective motion, and cavity QED systems, where I can just give you an example from an experiment we did a number of years ago at MIT. So this is just some data showing essentially as a function of the number of photons that were scattered into the resonator in this process, essentially what does the resulting quantum state look like? And the intuition says that I should sort of start with something that is this round uncertainty distribution and that it should kind of shear out. And in fact, if you do some kind of tomography measuring the width of the state in various directions, one in fact can reconstruct precisely this type of evolution that you expect, where again the different colors here are for more and more photons scattered into the resonator. Okay, so it works. And one thing you might observe, if you look at this plot carefully, this is a log-log plot where kind of the minimum indicates the size of the minor axis, the maximum indicates the size of the major axis, and it's not symmetric about one, which means that actually the area of the state is growing. Okay, so this is actually an indication that there's some that quantum. So this would be a nice area-preserving evolution. Okay, so actually there's some information leaking out of the system, and so these are not the coherent dynamics I promised you, and that turns out actually the sort of figure of merit that coupling to decay ratio in the system though was only 0.1. So if we want to move towards more coherent dynamics, we need to push this figure of merit up. And that's one direction that, we're taking in my lab. So just to offer kind of a little bit of inspiration, so actually before I go ahead, I just want to emphasize, despite the dissipation, this is actually already generating useful entanglements, and these states are narrower than the original unentangled state, and this is actually something we were able to use to enhance the precision of an atomic clock. But I think this is not a precision measurement audience, so I won't talk about that anymore. I want to get to interesting many-body physics. So, okay. If one can push this into a regime of coherent interactions, this is an interaction that already does more than squeeze, okay? So I just wanted to kind of give an illustration. So on this kind of block sphere picture, right, this twisting eventually gives rise to some interference effects. Well, in the extreme case, if you could do this long enough in a sufficiently coherent evolution, the ultimate effect would actually be, this is looking at the front and the back of the sphere to generate some kind of macroscopic superposition Schrodinger cat state. Okay, so that is kind of the realizing that extreme level of coherent dynamics requires very, very strong atom-like coupling. And, okay, so kind of motivated by this direction of going to more interesting entangled states, we said, okay, how can we design an experiment to do that? And we're motivated not just by having highly coherent interactions, but actually being able to take advantage of the fact that they're non-local, right? In order for it to be meaningful that the interaction is non-local, I need to be able to combine it with some local control. And so this is actually not such a trivial combination. So on the one hand, getting strong atom-light coupling requires that the mode of the light be very tightly focused compared to the atoms. And on the other hand, though, so we need somehow to track the light tightly, but at the same time, we need to be able to send light in to control the interactions. And so the requirement is that one needs a very tightly focused Gaussian mode, but at the same time, one needs some mirrors that are very far apart. And so that kind of dictates that we're operating in a rather tricky regime of cavity QED, where we have two mirrors that are separated by almost twice their radius of curvature. They were separated by exactly twice their radius of curvature, the mode here would come to a point. We back off from that a little bit, and the mode is small. It's small. It's difficult to align. But once you get it there, you can have very strong atom-light coupling. And so what it looks like is this. Just one slide of an apparatus here. So these are actually two mirrors. They're 5 centimeters apart. And there's a large window here below so that one can address the atoms that will be trapped there. Okay, all of this is mounted on some nice alignment stages so we can get align it in this configuration that gives the tightly focused waist. And okay, as one kind of aligns and tweaks the length and makes the focus smaller and smaller, this figure of merit for the coherence of the interactions skyrockets, and in this particular case, we expect that to be a factor of 50 in the current design, which is orders of magnitude higher than what I showed, than in the sort of dissipative dynamics I showed.
So,
how does
that measure the data?
Good, yeah. So actually, there are a couple of ways you could imagine measuring this, and one that we're hoping to do very soon is actually measure it with the aid of the atoms, which involves looking, so this G, the atom-light coupling, corresponds to a vacuum Rabi splitting that one would see, a mode splitting that one sees if I put an atom in the resonator and probe it directly. But in this case, it's actually measured. It's measured purely on the cavity itself without atoms. And so there are two things that go into this. One is we need to know the finesse, so the lifetime of a photon in the cavity, and that's simply a ring down measurement where we send in light, suddenly turn it off, and watch how long it takes to decay, roughly speaking. And then one needs to know how tightly focused is the mode, and it turns out that that's something that one can actually extract very precisely simply by the transmission spectrum of the cavity. And so in the limit where, this concentric limit where the mode is a point, actually all of the transverse modes are degenerate. We're not quite in that limit, and so actually by measuring the spacing between different transverse modes, we're able to extract spectroscopically that waste. So it's actually amazing how much information one can get just by spectroscopy of the cavity.
Also, you had two couplings. You had G and this other omega couplings.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, so in this diagram, there's G. Thanks. So G is the atom, just the vacuum Rabi frequency, the atom cavity coupling. This omega, and actually it's missing from the diagram, but as the color suggests, that is the Rabi frequency of a control laser. And so that's simply a classical field that I'm sending in from the side to turn on or off the interaction. Okay. So, okay. And as I said, we're looking forward and hopefully the next days or weeks to really measuring out with the atoms and starting to act to make them interact. It's just a picture showing that we have atoms in the resonator and we're watching the light that they're scattering out as we scan across different loads. Okay. So hopefully we'll be doing physics with this soon. And, sorry?
Is that as a function of time, or what's on the right there?
Yeah, so that's actually as a function of time. That's exactly right. So in this case, I'm actually scanning the length of the cavity so that different transverse modes are resonant.
Oh, okay.
And watching, so depending on the cavity frequency, that could either be a TEM00 Gaussian mode or some higher order mode.
You're looking at different modes.
And so we're just seeing that, yeah, the light scattered by the atoms. And basically, to be honest, we did this just for fun, to see some signal that that the atoms are in fact coupled to the resonator. But the next step is to actually have them confined in a lattice and very controllably introduce the types of interactions they talk about.
What is the frequency of the transversal spacing of the modes?
The frequency of the transverse mode spacing is tens of megahertz. Yeah. And that's to can be compared to a cavity line that's about 50 kilohertz. And so they're actually well resolved in this case. Okay. So something's a little bit odd here. Good. So we have a setup for engineering these types of non-local interactions. Okay. So the second, question I wanted to address is, okay, how would one in this type of system, or generally in other many-body systems, diagnose how chaotic are the dynamics as an indication of this scrambling. Okay. And the idea is that one, the sort of notion of chaos is that it should be characterized by some kind of a butterfly effect of some small perturbation exponentially growing. And to have a really intrinsically quantum mechanical definition of this, that's a notion I can think about already classically, but what does that mean in a quantum many-body system? Okay, and so in this context, it's been pointed out that the right thing to look at is how commutators grow in time. And so in particular, the quantity that we'll be thinking about is the commutator between some simple operators, I'll call them V and W, which could be, for instance, independent rotations of two different spins in a many-body system, which at equal times would commute. And what we'll be looking at is how fast do they fail to commute due to interactions in the system that convey information about this perturbation here over to influence this other spin, for instance. Okay, and so what we'll be looking for, and what would be a signature of chaos, is some exponential growth in this commutator. Okay. And so, equivalently, let me step down to this picture. So, essentially, the question, right, is I start with some quantum state, I apply this perturbation V, then I let the system evolve for some time, and at a later time I apply this perturbation W. And what I want to compare is the final state if I do this, versus if I let the system evolve for some time t under interactions, apply this operation w, then go back in time and apply the operation v. And the question is, how different are those two? So to kind of put it maybe a little bit more, to give a little extra intuition for it, another way I think of this is, so this upper kind of branch here is me giving you this talk with all of the slides in the correct order, right? So I give you some crucial piece of information at the beginning of the talk, and then as I proceeded through the talk, you understood everything that you know, systematically built upon it. The bottom branch here is me actually forgetting to give you that crucial piece of information at the beginning of the talk, and then going through the rest of the talk, and you're getting increasingly confused and more confused, and then at some point, I realize, oh gosh, I forgot to give you that information. I flip back through all of my slides to give it to you. So there are actually a couple things that could happen. If I realize pretty quickly, like one slide too late, that I need to go back, you might actually not be that confused. But if I go through the entire talk and then realize that I forgot something important on the first slide, I have to flip back all the way. So as a function of time, this sort of overlap between the happy you and the confused you is going to get smaller and smaller. And that's the thing that we're actually trying to measure, okay? So, and so what that looks like is actually this correlation function that I'll call f of t, right, which is the overlap between applying v and then w at the later time versus applying w at the later time and then going back in time and applying v. Okay, so if you'd like to measure this, then the kind of the ingredients that it seems we need are some way of going back in time, which will be switching the sign of my Hamiltonian, and some way of measuring this overlap, which involves performing some kind of many-body interferometry, right, where I measure the overlap between states produced by these two different many-body evolutions. And so I should say, so these were kind of the natural tools that occurred to, I didn't mention them already, to me and my collaborator Brian Swingle. I should mention that there are a few alternatives that have recently been proposed, employing, for instance, two copies of the same many-body system instead. Okay, but I'll focus on how we can use these tools of time reversal and some form of interferometry to measure this out-of-time correlator. Okay, right, so the idea would be, in order to be able to measure this overlap, what I'll do is I'll have a many-body system and then one additional control qubit. And conditioned on the state of that qubit, if it's in the, say, the one state, it will cause some perturbation v. If the qubit is in zero state, it won't, right? Then we will evolve for some time, apply w, evolve with the opposite sign of the Hamiltonian, and then we'll flip, do a pi pulse on this qubit, so flip 1 to 0. And so if the qubit was initially in the 0 state and we didn't perform the operation V here, we'll instead perform it at the end. Okay. And so if you perform the sequence and in the end you measure the qubit in the x or y basis, so projecting onto some superposition of 0 and 1, then those measurements will give you the real and imaginary parts of that out-of-time order correlation function. Okay. And there are actually a couple of different scenarios you can imagine for sort of the types of operations you might consider it for this V and W. So I gave a picture before where there are local rotations of single spins. And another example that I'll consider that's sort of natural for thinking about a globally interacting spin model, which is an example I want to give, will be some small global perturbations one can still ask the same question of how their commutator grows in time. Okay, and actually the reason I want to do that is because I like these globally interacting spin models as a starting point for being able to get some intuition by sort of being able to visualize the quantum state and also being able to do as sort of a simplistic experimentalist, do some numerical analysis of, for instance, how robust is this to dissipation. Okay, so I'll give kind of an example in a globally interacting spin model of what one might expect to measure. And in terms of how one would actually implement this, right, the picture I have in mind is that I have in my cavity some ensemble of atoms with interactions that are generated by some control fields that are addressing them, and then separately also in the resonator I can have a qubit that's really spatially separated And can, for instance, map a superposition of the qubit being in spin up or spin down into a photon being in the cavity or not, which would exert some phase shift, say, on this entire ensemble, and that would be my qubit-controlled operation. So that's a natural type of operation to consider in a globally interacting model, but I should emphasize that this could also be a richer model with some non-local interactions, and this could be some local gate between the qubit and a single spin of the ensemble. Yeah?
On the previous slide, you were evolving backward in time?
Yes.
It's a chaotic system, so how are you able to do that?
Well, okay, so I mean, there are maybe two questions. One is just in general, how do I switch the sign of the Hamiltonian? So I think that's not your question. Is that your question? Or is that
no, my one? Question is if you make a small mistake.
Yeah, so the question is if you make a small mistake. One thing that I'll give you a little bit of an analysis of that there are various types of mistakes you could make. One that naturally comes to mind is what is the impact of dissipation in the system? So if a photon is lost somewhere in this process. You could also think about some rotations, some error in the rotations. And so I'll give an example kind of showing the influence of dissipation and showing that for kind of reasonable parameters, it seems that one can still see something interesting. There are also questions about if I have some other errors. And there are actually some ideas for essentially normalizing out the effects of rotation errors. And it involves some more complicated measurements than what I'll show. But by doing this particular protocol and then referencing it to a slightly different protocol, that's a direction.
Is this special to quantum systems? I mean, for classical systems, it seems hard to imagine you could take a chaotic system and start evolving backward in time.
Yeah. No. I mean, and I think, my intuition is it's probably harder for a quantum system. I was very concerned about the fact that this is not a perfectly coherent dynamics, and what will the dissipation do? And somewhat surprisingly, but I'll give a bit of intuition for it. It seems that one can nevertheless extract some useful information. But I think it's an important question that we haven't fully answered in terms of what role errors in control will play. So. My collaborator, Brian, has done some analysis showing that one can, in fact, measure this out-of-time order correlator by the sequence and do some reference measurements and actually kind of normalize out the effects of errors.
Actually, is this because quantum systems aren't really chaotic in the same sense? That they're not, if you change the initial state, it doesn't matter much, since the inner product is preserved in time. It's only if you change the Hamiltonian. But, I mean, that's why you have to have this fancy. So maybe it doesn't.
I don't have a simple answer, actually, as to how the classical and chaotic and quantum systems compare, and I'd be interested to chat about that.
I think the short answer is yes. I mean, it's the quantum systems.
Sorry, say that again? Yeah.
I think the short answer is yes to this question.
Maybe another way to think about it, actually, maybe this is a good and useful intuition. Somehow, there's actually kind of a classical limit where I go to many particles, and certainly, I would say in that many particle limit, I should actually be more sensitive in some sense to some. So I have some intuition that if I have some errors that are small compared to kind of the quantum fluctuations, then maybe it's actually not so bad. And in the classical limit, those fluctuations become small. So I don't know if that. No?
Discuss the thing.
Yeah, okay. Another question. Yeah.
What is the effective temperature of the system?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So actually, in general, what people are usually thinking about is doing this type of measurement for a thermal state. And there, this kind of relaxation time scale depends on the temperature. And then one expects the scrambling time to be proportional to that, but become longer in proportion, longer in a way that depends on the entropy. But I actually will give an example where I'm not starting in a thermal state, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's say you can measure this f of t, so then you watch it. It's supposed to grow exponentially, and you look at its growth.
What you expect is initially an exponential growth in the commutator, and the corresponding that corresponds actually to a decay in this correlation function, which is 1 minus the real part of the commutator.
Okay.
And so what one is looking for is a decay in this correlation function. Other questions at this point?
So you measure a real imaginary part of it, or
So it's actually the real part of it that's the, yeah, so I can just go back. So the real part of the correlation function is the what is what's directly related to the commutator. And if anybody has an interpretation for the imaginary part, I'd be very interested, because what we sort of see typically is it seems to behave in a similar way in terms of how it decays. But I actually don't have a good physical interpretation for how to think about the imaginary part. This interferometric approach gives you access to either one. It's just a matter of which basis I measure the qubit in. Yeah?
So this might be wrong, but if you consider the expectation value of the commutator times the anti-commutator, or the anti-commutator times anti-commutator, then you can isolate the real imaginary.
Okay, maybe we should talk about this later. I don't want to get sidetracked too far. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a more simple-minded question. So this thing, I mean, we define it, if there's one minus, it's bounded basically between 0 and 1. So let's say it starts at 1, you'll get 1 minus the commutator.
Yeah.
Then it can't get smaller than 0.
Right.
So you want to see an exponential deviation from 1. But obviously the exponential can't go on forever.
So my understanding is that this bound applies to, well, in particular, the initial decay is what one expects to be fastest. Or maybe
it's
I didn't
fast,
say that, but this bound applies
to
the initial decay.
Time to measure an exponential. I don't really.
So, okay.
It's.
I think there are different timescales one can look on. So, I mean, one question, for instance, is if one looks for very long times, how small does it get? And does it really get, you know, to be order 1 over 2 to the n? Which is somehow what I would expect if it's really fully scrambled. As an experimentalist,
I don't think
I thought more about what the early time decay, because that's what seems most realistic
what I'm
to look
about
at.
The early time decay.
Yeah, and so maybe I don't quite understand the question. Yeah. So
you know, you can only just if you want as an in an experiment to resolve an exponential, you need to see many e-foldings of the exponential, right? You need to see many decades, right? But the function can't go, it starts at 1 and can't get smaller than 0. So to see many decades, I need an exponential which either has somehow a very, very long time scale or a very, very small prefactor.
Yeah,
is there a physical reason
in
an experiment why that is supposed to be the case?
So I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but one thing that I'll show as an example is kind of looking at how this scales with system size, for instance, which that's kind of one interesting question, right? And the fast scrambling would be seeing something where the decay goes as the log of the entropy. And so as a starting point, one can even just say, you know, what is the half-life of this thing, right? And how does that scale with system size? So let me just show kind of a plot.
He's asking if you have the dynamic range to measure the half-life. That's the question.
So let me show some plots, and then maybe we can come back to your question.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Great. We flipped back. Okay. So just to kind of, you know, get some intuition for what one might see in a measurement, we decided to look at an example of a chaotic model that one can engineer in this type of collective spin system, and that's a time-dependent model of a kicked top. It's a little bit similar maybe to a kicked rotor might be more familiar. So the Hamiltonian is essentially one where there's a stroboscopic alternation between a kick, which is this nonlinear SX squared Hamiltonian, and some precession, which is SZ. And so my kind of intuition in this phase-space picture in the Bloch sphere is that I start from that coherent spin state, and as I kick it more and more times, eventually this quasi-probability somehow spreads over the entire sphere. And that's the kind of visualization of the quantum chaotic behavior. And since the initial kind of solid angle of that uncertainty distribution is 1 over n on the sphere, so 1 over root n in phase, so 1 over n in solid angle, what I would expect, and this is a well-studied model, is that the number of kicks for this kind of spread over the entire sphere is going to go as log n. Okay, so that's kind of some intuition from this phase space picture. And now we ask the question, okay, so what happens if we look at the outer-time correlator for this model with, where we're probing it with some small rotations, my V and W will actually just be the same, and they're both rotations about the z-axis by an angle that's equal to the quantum noise of the state, so just enough to resolve a rotation. Okay, and so for reference, actually, we first asked the question, what happens if I don't look at this fancy out-of-time-order correlation function, but I look at simply a time-ordered correlation function, which is more like kind of your Loew-Schmidt echo, right? Similar to something where I would say evolve, perturb a little bit, and then try to evolve, or evolve and then try to evolve back under a perturbed Hamiltonian. Okay, so I called that G, and this plot is essentially showing what that correlator does as a function of the number of kicks at a range of different atom numbers. And, okay, so it shows some decay. It seems like it decays a little bit faster, actually, the higher the atom number, which is not what we would expect for this out-of-time correlator. Okay, so now we go to the out-of-time correlator and look at this for various atom numbers ranging from 10 to 500. And we, in fact, see some time scale that is growing with the number of atoms in a way that seems consistent with something that's maybe log of the number of atoms as we kind of expected from the intuition on the previous plot, on the previous slide. Okay. And so this kind of matches the notion of some sort of butterfly effect on the Bloch sphere. We see the same behavior in this out-of-time correlator. And just as a quick sort of check to see whether people are following, I want to ask the question, is this potentially a fast scrambler? If it's growing as log n? Nope. Yeah. Do you want to give me a reason why?
Well, you want entropy, right?
Sorry.
You want 2 to the power of that, right?
Well, so actually, if I really were in this kind of full space of all possible states of n spins, then the entropy, right, it's a 2 to the n dimensional space, and the entropy is n, right? But in this case, I actually kind of restricted myself to this space of symmetric states. All my interactions, my perturbations all keep me in that space, which is actually only n-dimensional, n plus 1-dimensional. And so somehow, if I want to kind of extend this this notion of a bound that goes with the log of the entropy to this system, I would actually say it should be something like the log of the log of the of n is the fastest that this can scramble. And in some sense, the fact that it's not going that fast to me is kind of the interpretation is that, that in some sense, maybe one interpretation is that the operations I'm doing, this small twist and this rotation, are still in some sense local in which degree, in local but on this Bloch sphere. Okay. The other point I should add is that actually, to the best of my knowledge, it's not even known whether there is a bound that applies to these time-dependent systems. I wanted to emphasize, I'm not trying to make any kind of a claim here that this is fast scrambling. This is just giving some intuition for a sort of example of a measurement one could imagine of this scrambling time in a chaotic system. And a key, takeaway from this plot for me is that a signature that I should look for if I wanted to do this in an experiment is this time scale that's growing with the number of degrees of freedom, which is different from what one would expect for a simple time-ordered correlation, a simple echo measurement, and also from kind of effects of decoherence. Okay. Yeah?
Explain again how you get a log in.
Oh, in this here?
No, in the...
How
do you see that this scrambling time is log?
Okay, so from this plot, how you would see that? Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to actually say something very concrete from this plot. Like, it's not some exponential that I can fit, right? If one looks at the time scale to decay by, say, a half, that's it's roughly consistent with a log n scaling, which is, I'm not trying to make any strong claim here, but it sort of matches the intuition of this butterfly effect on the sphere. Does that... I don't want to be making any kind of, any very strong claim here, but I think it's interesting that one can see this timescale that's growing, and it seems, you know, it's not growing linearly in n, it's consistent with this log n behavior, but yeah, yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so then the other thing, you know, I worry about, of course, is what happens when there's some dissipation. I did my, you know, we do our best in the lab to make the most closed system we can, but it's never perfect. Okay, so from looking at this timescale, one can say something about how large that cooperativity parameter actually would need to be to do this in a real cavity QED experiment. Okay, the sort of comforting that it is something that depends on the log of n and not on n in terms of maybe being able to scale this to reasonable atom numbers. So, okay, we did just one simulation looking at what actually one would expect to observe in a system with some dissipation. We chose a cooperativity parameter of 100 for this particular model. It's just a quantum trajectory simulation, and see that in this case, the dissipation has an effect, but the short time behavior, there's it seems that one can still see a clear difference between the behavior of the time order and the out of time correlator. And I would love to show, you know, how this actually scales with the dissipation and how it gets worse. And it turns out actually this calculation becomes hard for us to do because we're no longer in this nice small symmetric Hilbert space. And actually the more photons one loses, the Hilbert space starts to grow exponentially. And so this was the best we could do, but this gives us some indication that even in the presence of some dissipation, this type of comparison between the time ordered and the out of time order correlator, there's a distinction that one can see, and one could, again, look for this type of how this scales with the system size. Okay. So, you know, I gave this example of a simple globally interacting model. This kind of, we have some intuition for it, we can visualize it. What, you know, would particularly be interesting is actually to take advantage of interactions that are non-local in a richer sense. And so the type of random circuit model that I showed earlier is something that one could, in fact, implement with some time-dependent local addressing in the resonator. There are proposals for using multimode cavities to look at spin glass models with some random couplings between spins. So I should mention again, this random circuit model is again a time-dependent one where it's not actually clear to what extent this bound applies. So ultimately, one wants to potentially, it's interesting to also look at this in some models that are not time-dependent. Okay, I mentioned these proposals for spin glasses because they're sort of connected intriguingly to the Sapsev-Yekutiev model, which, in terms of sort of this non-local form of interactions, which is one model that is known to be maximally chaotic. So I don't claim to have a way of realizing this in a cavity. This is something that involves fermions. I have spins. But there are actually some intriguing proposals for actually realizing this model in other platforms, and the general type of protocol I applied is something that they've one of these preprints considered implementing. They look complicated, but on the other hand, you know, I showed you early in my talk a proposal for a particular Hamiltonian that the authors had no idea how to realize, and you know, with time we make progress in quantum engineering. Okay, so but beyond actually saying, you know, we want to make a black hole in the lab, I think it's also interesting to ask the question, is this timescale something that should be measured in other many particle systems, and there's actually lots of it seems every day there's a new paper on the archive about what the scrambling time can tell you in terms of its distinct behavior in ergodic or localized phases, single particle or many body localized phases, relationships between the Lieb-Robinson bound and the slower velocity associated with the scrambling process, butterfly velocity. So these are all things that would be interesting to look at in actually local models, and there are actually a number of different experimental platforms where the same type of protocol could be applied. One that we're particularly interested in my lab is actually going towards studying lattice spin models with long-range interactions that are generated by coupling atom, ground state atoms to Rydberg states with some van der Waals interactions that extend over many microns.
You can ask, I don't know. I don't have very extensive background on this, so I don't really, this is a very basic question. So what do you expect from the generic system?
Yeah.
So do you expect that it, you know, generic system has this butterfly effect, or it's a, spe- you, it's a special system that you're looking for that have these differential decay of this problem?
One expects it in a non-integrable system. So something like Ising model in a transverse and longitudinal field is kind
so
of
so excluding integrable models, all systems are expected to have this butterfly effect.
I don't feel comfortable making that statement.
Maybe not
all I don't actually know. Yeah, but the natural system where one expects to see it would be a systems that are non-integrable, and if it's something like this kind of a local model, what one expects is in particular that the commutator grows in a way that would be something like if I have two operations that are local but at different places and different times, I'd expect to see some growth that goes as e to the some you know lambda x minus vt, let's say, right? I expect and to again be able to look at some Lyapunov exponent in this case.
Right, but I guess I'm trying to understand what you're after. Like, so if it's fairly generic, that most systems, let's say, excluding two long.
My understanding is that it's something fairly generic, and
so
it's a time, and it's in some sense a fundamental time scale that hasn't really previously been probed, and so that's kind of, I would say, the most basic argument for why, you know, why this is worth looking. Is that
the behavior is generic, but it has never been measured.
It has not been measured. Yeah, up to maybe some very, very recent experiments are starting to probe this correlation.
I guess it's dependent on degrees of freedom.
Yeah, exactly. How does it scale as log s? Does it scale right? Or does it scale slowly? Yeah.
And I'm not an expert. But my earlier question was a little bit asking this direction because I don't, you know, in these papers which talk about this, there's a big deal made of the difference between this time and some short decoherence time. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be longer, and these are always models which have some large parameter, like a large n or non-local interaction.
I think that
or semi-classical. It's not clear to me that if you have a generic local interacting system, that there is necessarily a hierarchy of timescales like this, and that there are really.
Maybe a point to make is that I think the reason people are looking at these models is that they're the ones that they are able to study using holographic techniques. These matrix
sure,
models.
But that doesn't mean that that's generic.
No, and so I think it's an argument for measuring it in sort of more normal systems, right?
That'd be great to measure.
Right, because I think those are actually the ones where it's hard to do the theory. And so this is sort of something where maybe quantum simulations can help. Is that... I think part of the answer is it's not entirely known, right? And it's certainly not known what types of exactly what the requirements would be to see the fast scrambling versus a different scaling. Yeah. Okay.
As long as it's large n, you're going to see it. I mean, assuming it's not special, it just requires large n to see. Yep. And you need 1 over
to
n.
To see a Lyapunov exponent, or to see...
Yeah, you just need large n, and assume it's not integrable.
And it's and non-integrable.
Oh, yeah.
Large n and non-integrable. Okay, so you probably know this better than I. So... What's the argument for that, actually? Yeah.
Well, just as... So if we assume it's chaotic...
If we assume it's chaotic, yeah.
And then the question is just, can you measure an exponent?
Right.
And Leon was saying you need some hierarchy. So any many-body system is large n, so you have the hierarchy.
Ah, okay. You're saying just in terms of, in the limit of...
Right? The short-range interactions.
Yeah.
It depends on the observable.
So again, I think in the short-range interaction, one wants to sort of look at, again, one expects to see some kind of butterfly velocity in terms of
So the velocity and time scale
if
are
if I sort of were to look at some diagram of, right? of how this correlator behaves as a function of separation in space and time. And
so there's some notion of a velocity that it takes to propagate information.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily exactly the same thing as chaos.
Right, and but
that's very robust, and that's established, and rigorous bounds, Lee Robinson.
But I think, my understanding is that there's a Lee Robinson bound.
Yes.
But this velocity might actually be could potentially be significantly slower, right? So this is a speed limit. But you know, there's a different velocity potentially associated with this
and yeah, but then again, so you need a reason, right?
For looking
at this question of is there a difference between
So the question is, are there other kind of, at low temperatures?
Require a special model, some feature of the system I'm studying, to separate those two velocities?
Yeah, and I think it's something that people are starting to think about, and I don't actually know all the answers there. This is something that would be great to chat about more. Maybe I don't want to get. Well, were there other questions at this stage?
Theoretical questions.
Exactly. Yeah. As far as I can tell, there's sort of rapid theoretical developments that I honestly can't claim to be fully keeping up with. But just a few weeks ago, my collaborator Brian Swingle has a new paper on the relationships between the Lee-Robinson bound and the butterfly velocity and some of these models that can be studied by the holographic techniques. And again, how generic that is, I'm not entirely sure. Okay. How am I doing on time, actually? I've been talking longer than I expected because we've had lots of great questions. Oh, okay. So I'll say a little bit about, because I talked about kind of this one direction of having light-mediated interactions in an optical cavity. I'll just say a little bit about an experimental direction that we're also kind of excited about pursuing in my lab, which is more in terms of new approaches to generating local models, such as maybe this Ising model and a transverse model in the field, in a kind of a system where one can have, again, time-dependent control of interactions. Think about doing things like switching the sign and studying this type of physics. So this is an idea that has been around for some time, but actually there have been recently just first experimental demonstrations. And the idea is that if I'd like to take two neutral atoms that don't ordinarily interact, except when they're right on top of each other, and give them some long-range interaction, what one can do is couple these states to some highly excited states of high principal quantum number, which these are these excited states. They have some interaction potential that can extend over several microns. And if I have, so the picture is I'd like to make some Ising model, let's say, between two round states, which I'll call spin up and spin down. And okay, so the approach is one takes a laser field and off-resonantly couples one of these states at the up state to a excited P state. And there's a process then in fourth order perturbation theory, which involves exciting two of these atoms and coming back down. So this is an off-resonant process in fourth order perturbation theory that has some detuning that if the atoms are very far apart is kind of fixed. But if the atoms come very close together, due to the interaction in this excited state manifold, this is much, much further off resonance, and this kind of the energy shift due to this process is blocked. And so the net effect is something that's rather interesting. It's basically gives rise to sort of plateau-shaped interaction potential that's flat out to some distance and then starts to fall off. This is a van der Waals interaction as 1 over r to the 6th, after some critical radius that's simply set by the laser detuning. So it's an interesting system because sort of in contrast to most other systems that are out there, it gives kind of a flat top potential, flat out to some distance, which I can kind of fairly nicely map onto some model with maybe nearest neighbor interactions or nearest and next nearest neighbor interactions or something that I can tune by my laser parameter. It's also something where I can, depending on the particular choice of states and the detuning of these lasers. In this particular case, I have a repulsive interaction potential between these spin-up atoms, but I can kind of flip things around quite easily to get something that's an attractive interaction potential. And this is, again, just the type of thing you'd want if you want to be able to do these kinds of echo measurements and extend this protocol to local spin models. Okay. And so there have been actually first
something got
hidden here. Okay. There have been first demonstrations of using this to do actually either a neutral atom 2-qubit gate just about a year and a half ago, and most recently in the past few months to generate Ising interactions in sort of a 2D system in a lattice. And so kind of the ingredients are now there. I think this is exciting because it's a very new method, and the ingredients are there that you can imagine doing both having this kind of switchable sign many-body interaction and also applying this 2-qubit gate to do some sort of local operations and do these types of measurements in these systems. Okay, so I think we actually talked enough about this, so I don't need to repeat what one hopes to see in this type of scrambling measurement. The last thing I just wanted to, I don't want to take too long, but I'll just put up a few slides saying another direction that we're interested in going, you know, as an experimentalist. Part of me is intrigued by the scrambling, and part of me says, oh gosh, I'm supposed to do an experiment where the thing I'm going to see is some signal that decays really fast. And somehow, you know, I like the idea of actually preserving coherence rather than destroying it. And so I've been intrigued by some suggestions from my collaborator, Norm Yao, who's for applying these kinds of optically controlled interactions for realizing symmetry-protected topological phases. And in particular, let me actually skip this. I won't talk more broadly about topology of curved atoms. In particular, there are some new ideas for actually using time-dependent control of interactions to engineer, say, an analog of the Haldane phase of a spin one Heisenberg chain. Okay, and so this is something that I think probably the audience is familiar with. Has kind of the unique and interesting feature that I start with this spin one Hamiltonian, and I end up with effectively a spin half degree of freedom at the end of the chain, and these are some robust, essentially a robust spin half degree of freedom at the end of the chain. Okay, and so there's a recent proposal by Chamoun and others for actually realizing this physics, not in a spin one system, but kind of emulating it in a spin half system with periodically driven interactions, which is interesting actually for a couple of reasons. One being that experimentally generating the right interactions in a spin one system might be non-trivial, and then also actually kind of cooling this system to low temperature is often a challenge in experiments, which kind of raises the question, on the one hand, spin one half models are potentially more experimentally accessible, but on the other hand, actually non-equilibrium physics is an interesting alternative to trying to prepare some equilibrium ground state. So can I have some spin half model where I just turn on some driven interaction and I see effects of this topological phase? Okay, and so the particular model inspired by this proposal that we started looking at with Warren and Dragos is essentially a spin half chain with an Ising interaction that essentially is alternating in sign between ferromagnetic and anti-ferromagnetic, not something that you naturally expect to see in a material, but something that by this kind of Rydberg dressing approach one could do. So this is kind of a unique possibility of a cold atom system. And so the model essentially is a dimerized model with essentially two different Ising couplings between these near neighbors and these atoms separated by twice this distance. And one can tune the dimerization, right, by tuning the essentially critical radius of this interaction. Okay, and so the idea would be that by time-dependent control of a laser field, one can in fact look at this type of engineered Floquet symmetry-protected topological phase. And then one challenge with any type of Floquet interacting physics is that, as you probably know, this tends to give rise to heating effects. And so Norm and Dragos have shown that if one has a transverse field that is disordered, then one can have a combination of many-body localization that prevents this runaway heating and engineered a symmetry-protected phase in a many-body localized system. So, okay, we thought that's a nice idea, and then the one sort of limitation was that there's a protecting Z2 cross Z2 symmetry here that has to do with essentially rotations about x either of these two sites of the dimerized model, which is actually in a realistic implementation where I don't just have these nearest and interactions, separation A1 and A2, but longer range interactions, those actually destroy the protecting symmetry. Okay. So on some time scale, maybe one can, you know, see some aspect of this physics, but that's a limitation. So then the sort of exciting realization was that, well, actually, whereas in a static phase, the sort of simplest protecting symmetry one can have is the Z2 cross Z2, there's recent work showing that actually there are Floquet topological phases that have no equilibrium analog. And can be protected by a different symmetry group, such as Z2 cross Z. And so in this particular case, this Z symmetry is going to be actually coming about from a symmetry under translation in time, so which is not something that one could think about in the static system. And, okay, and so here again, the type of scheme would be something where one has alternating a stroboscopic alternation between interactions, some Ising interaction, and then turning off the interaction, but turning on a coupling field between two spin states. And that would realize precisely this Floquet Hamiltonian. And in contrast to the one that was simply emulating the static phase, this one is actually robust to long-range interactions, and interestingly, it's even easier to implement. I don't even need to switch the sign of an interaction. It's just turning it on and off, so it's as simple as turning on and off a laser. And so I hope this kind of gives an idea of what one can do in a cold atom system and with these sort of developing new tools that could allow for exploring completely different phases of matter than previously been studied or than can naturally be realized in solid state experiments. Okay, so there's sort of a bit of a caveat that I have to say to be perfectly honest, and that's, so here's kind of a calculation of what one would expect to see in this driven system, showing essentially an autocorrelation of, say, the black would be the Z projection of the spin at the end as a function of time. The blue and the red here are spins in the bulk. Okay, and the interesting thing to look for in an experiment would be, can one actually, taking advantage of the ability to, you know, locally probe the system, see a difference in coherence between bulk and edge spins? And, okay, the challenge is that, again, we do our best to engineer very closed systems in the lab. Realistically, I'm using some excited states to generate interactions. There's always a finite coherence time, which is roughly something like this white window here. Okay, so it looks promising enough that one can expect to see something. It's still not, from the perspective of preserving quantum information, there's still ultimately here a challenge to be addressed. And if anybody has in the audience has ideas for protecting quantum information in the presence of dissipation, then I'd be happy to hear them. But nevertheless, in terms of probing the physics, the timescales appear promising. Okay, so these are just, you know, a few ideas that we're excited to explore, but there's much to be done to build up the apparatus to do it, and so all of these people are working on that. But I particularly want to acknowledge my collaborators, Brian Swingle in particular, and also Patrick Hayden on the scrambling work, Travis and Norm on the symmetry-protected topological phases, and my research group, Greg is also, my student Greg, involved in the scrambling work. both of these built the beautiful cavity that I showed in the previous slides. So that concludes my talk, and I'll be happy to take more questions. Yes?
For the non-locally coupled spin system you showed, what Lyapunov exponent do you get?
For the globally interacting one?
Or locally, either one.
Sorry.
There was some system you showed in which you were going to measure this.
Something like the Ising model. So I mean, I showed the kick talk where I showed actually the, some numerical simulations.
Maybe I meant the random circuit model. I guess.
Just so the random, yeah. The random circuit model, there's essentially, you have this, time scale of the gates, right? And then what I expect is that the scrambling time is just the log of the number of qubits in units of that time scale.
With what prefactor?
I think the prefactor is really just the time scale of implementing this 2-qubit gate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I just wanted to know if the random circuit model actually saturates the bound.
I think one thing that's important to emphasize is that the bound doesn't quite apply to the random circuit model because it's a time-dependent Hamiltonian.
Oh.
Right. Yeah. So the bound doesn't quite apply, and the main reason that it's interesting is that it gives some intuition. Well, I find it interesting because it gives some intuition for kind of something for how the bound comes about. But the bound doesn't quite apply.
But one can still calculate for at least.
Yeah, one can still calculate it, and I have to admit, I'm actually. So this is a paper by Patrick Hayden and Nima.
But
yeah.
No one, theoretically, no one can calculate the Lyapunov exponent for anything except the SYK model.
Right.
That's why I'm curious to know what its value is for anything else.
So this random circuit model was. So I know that it shows this scaling, this log S scaling, which was already interesting, and I have to admit I don't quite remember what the conclusion was about the prefactor. I'm also...
It's going to be bounded. We have a paper on this.
Yeah.
You get the scaling with a prefactor. It's not necessarily tight, but you do get it.
I mean, the only model I know of that really saturates this bound is this SYK model. So I can say, the other thing I can say is in the paper that considered this random circuit model, there are actually two models considered. Another one that was considered is an Ising model with some random interactions. And there was sort of a weak form of fast scrambling that they saw, where it depended on exactly whether they looked at sort of correlations in X or correlations in Z, let's say. But in terms of actually saturating the bound, to the best of my knowledge, what's known to saturate it is only this SYK model. But actually, you say there is a way of formulating a bound for the time-dependent system?
Well, it's not necessarily tight, as I said, but yeah, there is.
Okay, so that's...
This model, this randomly fluctuating model.
Okay, that's interesting to me, actually. I wasn't, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't want to delay too much, so a quick question. So about the second part of your talk.
Yeah.
If you have a system that's localized, that will store information for a long time anyway, right? So how would you see the effect of the edge nodes? Why exactly, what is the main premise of using that?
Totally
see it in an experiment, actually.
Yeah, so what one expects is that one essentially drives the system and looks at an autocorrelation of the spin. And in particular, the edge mode in this case is really something that is actually, it's really well localized at the edge. So there's an operator I can write down that's essentially the z component of this effective spin half is actually the z component of the spin at the end. And I think the x and y components involve the two edge spins. And so one looks at the correlation, autocorrelation of that, and that's essentially what was plotted in this figure. What one expects is that for perturbations that sort of respect the symmetry, The edge spin is robust, but one would see some decay in coherence if the bulk strikes. And does that help, or what, in looking at this autocorrelation? And so in fact, this difference can be enhanced if one were able to add, say, an XX interaction, which would be an example of that further destroys the coherence of the bulk spins but preserves the coherence of the edge. Is that okay? Other questions?
Thank Mark again.
I'm around. So.
Until when? Just today, or?
I'm around until I'm through tomorrow. So
tomorrow,
yeah.
So we'll have.
So yeah.